be a minute every day. I'm ready to do it. I'm getting to have to wait until the very last second to come in. And that's when I'm going to close last second. The quarter is over. I'm very discouraged. I haven't done it. We won't keep my truck the rest of my three fourths of my class. So, thank you. Just a minute of your friend of mine. I know y'all didn't get from the view of it. It's such a line forward up here. if you came out against if a man were fighting in single combat, this idea of single combat is a Greek idea, but just to do ballistic in general, seems to be strange. The Jews would have never heard of it before. And if you got that, you know, one, your champion, this is my champion, winner take all. There was a Greek idea of having the ballistics were these people. And but anyway, if you came out, if a man came out against you, not properly attired, with proper armor on, glistening, creaking, clanking, that was a great insult. This is why he said to David, come out, but not because of David's weapon. The sling is not a child's toy. It's not a child's weapon. It's a deadly weapon. 700 pound Benjamin had to split a hair with it, the left hand. And exceedingly powerful weapon. Anyway. My point is that the ancient Greeks had engaged in single combat, and it made for great heroes, and it made for great storytelling around the campfire night. Made for great songs, great literature, for Homeric epic poetry. It's a good way to lose a war. drop by one at a time. And so they learned by the Greek, by the historic theory, by 750 BC on, the Greeks developed what's called a phalanx. They found that fully on the hero business, if you're going to win the battle, you had to stay together. So they would form these squares, which came to be is basically the old British square. By the way, you know that in the Revolutionary War, one of the reasons that the British lost in the American woods was that they insisted on finding the old British square. You line up, on the front line shoots, they kneel down, second line load, and then they fire and they kneel down the third line, and they do the load, the third line fires over their head, they kneel down and load, the back line fires over their head, then they load, front line's ready to stand up and shoot again. And, stuff down like that. It's a withering fire. And the British use that all through the 19th century in India, they're still using it. I'll believe. And just like the American Revolutionaries cut them to pieces, they make a great party. They all stay together, they got in the open, and they know where they're going to be, and you get behind a tree and take them off. That's what they did. They got this idea from the old group, from the Roman legion, who got it from the Greeks, the old phalanx, where you all lined up, and you know they had a musket firing over each other, so they had spears, front line would have spears, and spears are very seldom thrown. Back in the old period, back in the days of the Homeric heroes, the Battle of Troy, they would throw them. They're not there to hang on to it. Once you threw it, you missed. All you got was the back. All you got was some idiot on the other side throwing back at you. What they did was they were holding on to it. They were thrusting weapons. And they learned to march, even run together in step, in unison. So this is the beginning of marching. That's what all the marching was, the traditional marching, the military, and the bagpipes, or the bugles, and the drums, or anything, was to set a cadence so we could all move together. That's what the drum of the war came to. It was to set a rhythm. And you would all run together. And the front line would have short spears. The longer, the back line would have, the next line would have slightly longer ones. The third, and you would lay across the shoulders. The third line had even longer ones, so it was just a solid wall of spears coming at you. And they could shift. They could, on a signal, they could all raise the spears up and say, if you were on the back line here, on the edge. All of a sudden, if they shifted, they would trade spears, and you would be on the front line. They could go in any direction with certain signals, and it was very effective. Romans learned this and developed it in their legion. So I said that the idea was that you either had heroes or you had victory. You had left another church, and the preacher likes to be the hero. So everybody working together. They had victory and heroes. Because the Romans knew this, the Roman general put his son to death, but his son's a great hero. The Romans need heroes. They need victory. The Roman army was highly polymathic, they're fighting, and the cavalry was a wing with an auxiliary force. The main thing was the Roman legion. And what they would do is,
that question, I'm sorry, but I don't know.
Now, did they get those ideas from the Greeks, the one fighting plus the group?
Well, the Romans had learned the lesson the Greeks had learned.
Oh, so they learned
the phalanx of a square, that you fight together with a line.
Thank you.
P-H-A-L-A-N-A. Now, the old Greek, the soldier who fought in this was called a hoplite, the Latin army. But anyway, but the
it finishing, do you?
Where was I?
When did the art group, when did they quit their job?
They were never popular. What they would do is, didn't use those very much. They had a what's called a composite bow, a combination of horns and wood. Very powerful. But they were not accurate enough. And it was because of armor and shields, they had very limited value. But what the Romans would do through their glory days, before the days up to the days of Augustus, back in the days when they were expanding, winning the Punic Wars, North Africa and Spain, southern France, they would use the Roman legions, and originally, to serve in a legion, you had to be a citizen. They wanted the Romans, interesting, they wanted the citizens. And these were the main lines. Then they would have cavalry, which would be citizens, auxiliary. And then they would have what we call auxiliary troops. But these would be mercenaries or troops recruited from the colonies, from their native lands. They would never depend upon them. They would be for mopping up actions, to help carry the baggage, to back you up. But when the fighting got tough, you see, where you really had to hit the line and penetrate, they wanted Romans. They wanted the Roman legion. And see, a man could serve 20 years in a legion. But if any man lived, served a march under in a legion, it was a legionary, they called him, say for 10 or 15 years, and was still alive, he was one tough cookie. I mean, he was a professional killer. You had learned how to sit and follow him. He really weeded them out. He was one tough old boy. And you get in the face of about 100 of them coming at you. He knew exactly what they were. They were absolutely ruthless. I'm talking about the common soldier. I'm talking about the officer. I'm talking about the men in the line. Over the years, it sort of sifted down. You know, say they were 20, 30 years. Most of it, just about all the men got his life. All his life. Man was 40, 11 years in that day. Well, you can see why this Roman army, I mean, there was no army in the world where it consistently defeated them. They stood and fought. It could not come close. It was iron. They probably marched under the eagle. And they were a terrible military force. Well, anyway, what they were made up of, there was a special, you read it in the New Testament about the Praetorian Guard. I'm talking about the Praetorian Guard. The Praetorian Guard was the emperor's, later on, by the time Augustus following, was the emperor's personal army. Sometimes called a personal bodyguard, but actually it's too big for a bodyguard. It's a personal army. What it was, this was supposed to be the elite of their own army. You had to be a citizen to be in this. And the Praetorian Guard, what they would do is they would keep, it dealt with the emperor's business. They would keep roughly one-third of the Praetorian Guard in Rome to protect the emperor. The other two-thirds they would have out in the provinces. But in any business that the emperor was to ready, see, there was a balance. I'll get into this later, but I'll mention it here. You see, some provinces were governed directly. Ultimately, everything was under Augustus. Everything, Augustus had the final say. But as far as the daily administration of certain colonies, Rome found that if a colony was obstreperous and recalcitrant, learned those words last night, they weren't used. They were hard to do anything with. If they tended to revolt, troublemakers, they would make this country, this province, they would call it, directly under the direct control of the emperor. Simply because he had to act fast. He wanted to, you know, he might have sent an army in. Keep his thumb on it. The easily controlled provinces were administered by the Senate. They had to keep a standing army, there's a pogan army there. No trouble. They paid their taxes and they minded their own business. No problem. It was administered by the Senate. Now, this is important to us because Judea, when Jesus is born, is a senatorial province, but after Herod the Great dies and Archelaus takes over, it becomes an imperial province, and then later on, by the time we get to the time of the death of Jesus, it's back as a senatorial province again. I'll talk about that later, but it shifts. Now, but what In the imperial provinces, that is, the provinces administered directly by the emperor, he would keep his private army there, and they would tend to his business. And this is why, when Paul appealed to Caesar, the second he appealed to Caesar, he became the emperor's business. Therefore, it was the Praetorian, therefore he was kept under guard by Caesar's private army, the Praetorian Guard. This is why Paul was guarded by a soldier in the Praetorian Guard. You got this? Because he appealed to Caesar, any business that Caesar was directly concerned with, that involved the military, this is transportation of a prisoner, the Praetorian Guard had this responsibility. Now they followed this principle of keeping only one third of the army in Rome, and two thirds out in the provinces, because the Senate, this is sort of a trade-off, because the Senate didn't like having too many soldiers responsible to the emperor in Rome. The emperor had a way of deciding to purge the Senate anytime they didn't agree with what the Senate said. And it was kind of a matter of keeping a balance of power. Now, the Praetorian Guard was ideal service. For instance, in the Praetorian Guard, it was the prestige regiment. The term of service was 16 years rather than 20 years. It's a good term of duty. You got that? You only committed yourself for 16 years rather than 20. They were the best paid. They were higher paid than the other elements in the Roman army. And they seldom fought. They paraded a lot. They were sort of a show, kind of like an honor guard in some way. You know, about the parade, about the spit and polish. Not very much fighting. That is, there was a dirty job. They had to put on slavery boats. Or there was a border conflict out in the village, you know, where they had to send somebody to do a dirty job, marched long and hard, and put down some barbarians. You didn't come to that. You sent another regiment, let them become cannon fodder. But it was a great honor being in the Praetorian Guard. Well, anyway, a legion was legion mean in Latin? Yeah. Well, that's it. And Roman numerals, the L. You know, this is what in L. That means that. Wait a minute. Legion is. I'm sorry. Yeah, at least it's 1,000, right? Let's say. Yeah, well, I'm better than that. Yeah. I'm trying to keep it up. Indicate 1,000 soldiers, a unit of 1,000. However, none of the legions ever had 1,000 soldiers. By Trajan's time, they had roughly a little over 500. And Augustus' time, probably 600. Why? Well, because at any given time, you could have a number who would be. Soldier, you know, in the leading aristocracy, or it might mean every man is amateur. because many of these men were very good and won great battles. But many of these, but you see, just because a man is born to the aristocratic family doesn't mean he makes a good commanding officer. There were a lot of terrible ones, and Rome lost a lot of battles that he not have lost simply because of the poor leadership. Because they took a good man, here's a man of senatorial rank, to give him a legion, and maybe he's a good officer, maybe he isn't. And there were a lot of bad ones. So it kind of balanced out. There were six military tribunes under this legate. These tribunes were of either senatorial rank or of equestrian rank. Let's talk about the equestrian rank. The equestrians were like a second class aristocracy. The equestrians were not of senatorial rank, but they were above the common everyday citizen. Originally, what does equus mean in Latin? Horse. Originally, the equestrian was a man who had enough money that when in time of war, and keep in mind the spirit of old Rome, you had money, you served at your own expense, a public servant in the real sense of the word. In the old system, like the Republic, the question that here's a man who had enough money to provide himself with a horse and with armor and with weapons, and therefore he would be in the cavalry if he did so, and he was mixed with a knight. You find this carried on in the Middle Ages. He was a knight, a horse soldier. Now later on, this became sort of an honorary title. And you see something like this when you see on a 4th of July parade or a Christmas parade, you have fellows who will, like in the, well, we have it here, up north we have the sheriff's mounted patrol. The auxiliary of the sheriff's department, which means that they put on the sheriff's deputy uniform and guns and rode horses. They did this every time there was a parade, and that was it. You know, they didn't do any real business, real law business. It was simply an honorary, they found it an honorary thing. And everybody had a lot of fun, and they got the horses around the parades, and they go to the weary, they kind of became that. Later on, by the first century, the equestrian rank meant anybody who had enough money to provide this kind of wealth, whether he did so or not. And probably it had nothing to do with direct military activity, but it was a rank in society, and I'll talk about it later. But he had so much money, and you could wear a gold ring, and many things in James chapter 1 about a man who enters the assembly with a gold ring, he puts it in the equestrian rank. These were, so the, this, you got this, this is not, this was the citizen, the honored citizen, who was above the average citizen, but below the senatorial rank, the equestrian. Now, that is sort of a second class nobility. And these tribunes had either the senatorial rank or an equestrian rank. And there were six of those per legion. And then, under them, you have the legate.
Legions were normally running 500 to 600, and you had six pigeons, you had as many centurions as you had pigeons, or you had more?
No, you had, it was supposed to be 1,000. You would have six tribunes over them, but they were divided, the legion was divided in 10 groups of 100, ideally, on paper, but they never had that many. If the centurion was over 60, he was doing well. Because they were always living, always living.
So that 10 centurion,
yes.
Centurion was?
Yes. Centurion could be what could come from, probably just be the average, had to be a Roman citizen. But he would not be at the equestrian rank or a senatorial rank. You got that? He's a common everyday citizen. Now, the average soldier, in originally, was a citizen too. However, by the time of Augustus, you had the average, the common soldiers would be anybody. You would have Roman legions, which would be made up of all Roman citizens. You would have legions that would have Roman officers, that have Numidian, have Greek. The Greeks were great fighters, especially Greek mercenaries. Mercenary fighters. You have Greeks. For instance, most of the soldiers in the Roman army who patrolled Judea in the days of Jesus were Samaritans, according to Josephus. Jews wouldn't serve in the army. They'd die. They wouldn't serve in the army. They'd fight against Rome, but they would not march under the eagle. So, while the officers were Roman, most of the soldiers in the Roman army in Jesus, in Palestine in the first century, were Samaritans. Not all of them. They were Greek and Samaritan.
Oh,
they were paid. That doesn't mean they volunteered, but they were paid, yeah.
How did Paul become a Roman citizen?
He was born to it. Either his father or his grandfather achieved it. We'll talk later about achieving citizenship a number of ways, by serving in great honor in the government some way or marrying a citizen. Okay, got this now? When a centurion was promoted, he was always moved to a different area. We had to think, in modern business, he was always moved to a different area. When a centurion was promoted, he was always moved to a different area. That is, he would always be, the Romans followed this policy that when you became an officer, see, a centurion was like a staff sergeant, but you became an officer, the man who had to decide who went into battle. The Romans learned what our military knows is, that it's best that the officers are not on familiar terms with the enlisted men. Why is that?
Because they
never
had a problem.
Yeah, they, if you know these fellows, this outfit maybe was 4 or 5 year old drinking buddies. So you may decide to send somebody else into the heat of the battle. Or you may be incoming decisive, but it's best. And the officer has to make this cold, hard decision that he knows it's going to cost life. It's been known, but the officer doesn't know he's going to be and he makes better decisions. It's similar now. So if there's all those rules, the military, and the officers over here, and the ordinary soldiers over here. There's very good reason for that. Well, anyway, so when a centurion was promoted, you see, he'd have a bunch of guys under him, just 100 or 60 or 70, however many he had, and they'd been through hell together. He had a 10th of the legion. If he was promoted, then what might he do? Yeah.
Are we taking him in with him?
No.
He'd send the other company.
Yeah, he'd pick some other, send other 100 to do the dirty work, to protect his. So when he was promoted, he had moved to another legion, so he would not know the men. And it's still done today, by the way. Anyway, the centurion was paid 15 times as much as an ordinary soldier. Now, the ordinary soldier, the line man, one below the centurion, was, I'm sad to say, for the most part, a bum. He was a killer. He probably had no education. Probably very poor. Very often, they would go in the army to do the army or jail. And by the way, some of the toughest fighting outfits in the world that have known have been made up primarily of criminals. But the most famous one is which? Fresh for Legion. Men had nothing to get, nothing to lose. And they were, and by the way, you find friends at peacetime even, you find men who speak in military here at Consul who tend to be men who are not the most global. Many, many, many exceptions. But the average soldier tended to be, let's say, if he lived that long, you know, if he had been there 5 or 6 years, he was tough. And these men were tough. They were amazing things.
We're the same thing now,
though. Yes. You're a problem, don't you? You're a volunteer.
That's why.
You often find fellows. Now, in wartime, when they just draft everybody, it's not like that. But very often in peacetime, you tend to find fellows in the military who are the carriers of the infantry. Very often, who have are losers in peacetime. That is, they didn't qualify for any technical school, or they didn't want to, or they can't get promoted because they keep getting drunk, you know, get drunk in the rain. Now, there are many exceptions. There are many exceptions. But peacetime army tends to be very moral, and because you tend to find fellows who get paid as low, they're not maybe the limited. But there are many exceptions to this. There's certainly true back then, but you just couldn't. Nobody wanted them around. And again, just like a soldier, everybody wants them around the war. Something was fighting to be done. When the fight's over, nobody wants them around. It's a tough situation. But anyway, and so it was very low, but the centurion was paid 15 times as much as the ordinary soldier, 5,000 denarii a year. Don't worry about that. And, the five top centurions in a legion, there would be 10 centurions in a legion, the five top were paid 10,000. You could move up in rank and considerable money. Now, therefore, you find the centurion that you meet in the New Testament. It was the centurion's house. He had a household, apparently had some wealth. He was a respected citizen, number one centurion, built a synagogue for the Jews. He was much loved by the Jews. These tend to be men who were noble, very often were men who were noble, had money, were respected in the community. So the highest paid centurion was called the Primus Pilatus, or First Spear. That's my first violin in the order. And if he was at the he had an honor, don't you have an honor within the military, don't you have somebody in an honor position, you know, when you march in formation, carry the flag? Is that true?
Oh, the guide on.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like this. He was a first centurion. His hundred were the first, the best. He was called the first spear. And he was the highest paid of all. He went from first spear up to becoming a tribune. So he moved up to a tribune. Now, this interesting to you? I think it's kind of like Captain Flavor, some of these men who you read about in the text of this centurion. And, you see, you find military metaphor and simile. Paul says, any man who's performed the army does not get involved, tell Timothy, does not get involved in the care of this world, because if you go in the army, you're in. You've got to fight for your life. And Paul talks about putting on the shield of faith and the helmet of righteousness, taking the sword of the Spirit, the word of God. And he had a military metaphor as well, similar in the New Testament writings. So one more thing, the soldiers had to buy their own food and clothes out of their salary. They received what was called a solarium, or a salt ration. They were paid. They received money, but they had to buy their own food and clothes. But they received a salt ration. Salt was very valuable in the ancient world. And by the way, it's a very old term we borrowed from the Romans, which is, he's not worth his, any man worth his salt. And the soldier was, you know, they would say this about a soldier, he couldn't depend on, he's not worth his salt. It's his salt ration, it was a very good gift. You also get wine rations sometimes, some places. Okay? That's the basic structure of the Roman army. Now, one more thing. And this is interesting, I think. The Romans, the Latin word for camp, if I have no idea. castra. Castra is the Latin word for camel. Castrum is the... Now, and many, I say this because that many sites in Western Europe, many cities, were originally Roman military camps, and cities grew up around them. And you see this in England, for instance. You have almost every other town of England, seems like, isn't true. Is Chester, you have Worcester saw, and Lancaster, and Chichester, and all these, any other in England, Winchester. Chester, at the end of the word, the anglicized form of Costa. Anytime you find these cities with that Chester or Coster, Lancaster, at the end, that's a city that was grouped in the Roman military camp. They were named from so-and-so camp. And the name stuck. It cost me. That's true. Now, while we're talking about this, let me talk about the free citizens, because this is involved, soldiers. The free citizens, this is an extra thing in your outline. You know, make it free, Roman numeral 3A or something, if you want a 3B or 3C, don't worry about it. I didn't stick this in. This is important to us because Paul was a citizen of Rome. Now, the free citizens, are sometimes called the third estate. There was a great number of citizens by the first century in the world of the New Testament, which were neither rich nor poor, but were simply citizens. Now, as Rome began to expand in the period, in the centuries, mainly the century before our period, the last of the Republic, remember I said that Rome originally expanded by fighting really defensive wars and then simply administering the conquered territory. And by this time, Spain had fought Carthage, the Punic Wars. The term Punic is a cognate to the word Phoenician. P-N-C, Phoenician means Punic. And the Carthaginians were Phoenician people. In fact, Dido, the founder of Tyre, the woman, Tyre, tradition says, and it's probably true, was related to Jezebel, Ahab's wife, who was a Phoenician. But they had, in the process of conquering this section of the world, they had acquired slaves. We're going to talk about slavery later, the sources of slavery, but let me talk here about the fact that this had a profound effect upon the citizens, and one of the reasons why the economy was in chaos, and one of the reasons why Augustus was so concerned about what we would call moral reform. You see, slaves became numerous. And according to the law of supply and demand, anything which becomes numerous becomes cheap, relatively so. A slave was not cheap, it had to be fed. It became relatively cheap. And what happened was that with the influx of slavery, it became possible for the wealthier citizens, mainly those of senatorial rank, to acquire estates and to operate them with slave labor. Now, what can you do if you have like a plantation and it's, or an estate in a lot where you sort of farm, maybe several hundred acres, and it's worked by slaves? What does that mean? What does it mean as far as the cost of production? It goes down. You can afford to sell your grain much cheaper. And one of the things that happened with it, probably, but the victory they acquired, many through prisoners of war, the rich landowners acquired many slaves, and we're talking about slavery itself later on, but it tended to drive a small farmer citizen out of business. And he had to sell his grain when prices were down and buy seed when prices were up. Added to this was the fact that it was very common for them to for a man to go to war, a citizen to leave his farm, in the keeping of paid servants or members of the family, to go to war and sometimes be gone 4, 5, or 6 years. And very often, this is in the generation before Augustus, before Julius Caesar, It's a common thing. I mean, it happened. It was a widespread thing that a man under these severe economic conditions, where he's competing with slave labor, where it's costing him more for grain and he's getting less and less for it, he would go to war and be gone 4 or 5 years and come back, and for these reasons and perhaps some other reasons, poor management, whatever, his farm would have been, he would have lost his farm. Thousands and thousands have experienced this. So here he was, destitute. He lost his farm, he'd been, you know. And also, what happened was that they would tend to borrow money to plant the crops and have to mortgage their farm. They had mortgages here before he could find his farm had been foreclosed. And this happened over a long period. In fact, there was a two brothers, the Gracchi, G-R-A-C-C-H-I, don't worry about this, but this is before our period. The famous Gracchian reforms was what, which is what produced the dole. The Gracchi, these senators, back in the Asian Republic, they realized that Himmler's men who had gone out and fought, only to come back and find that their farms, if they'd lost their farms, lost the family, they said they were citizens now. And they were starving. And so they were the ones who started the welfare state. Said the state owes these men this. We ain't been there. They must be fed. And then it expanded to all citizens were fed, at least about all. And so there was, by the time of the first century, by our period, Rome, especially the city of Rome, but many major cities in the Roman Empire, the major cities, were filled with free citizens who were destitute. There were a number of other reasons, but this was one of the primary reasons. Now, this is why. This was the mob, the famous mob. And the mob had to be cared for. Now, you have to do two things to a mob. Mob is a very dangerous thing. See, these people were not educated. They were culturally very low. They depended upon the state for their dole, lived off the state, and they were idle. And they were resentful because many slaves, as we're going to see later, were better off than they were. It's very common to find slaves who were better off than citizens. And you see, and a part of these people could not work. Many of them would not work. Why? They were citizens of Rome. The big thing to be a citizen. Remember, Paul could claim his citizenship and be honored because of it? The very fact he was a citizen. Well, if you were a citizen, you'd starve very often before you'd go out and do a slave's work. This is the summer generation. Maybe you'd own slaves. They had fed the pigs. Were you going to do it? Well, I'll starve first. Human pride. And men were just lazy. So you had in the major cities, especially Rome, you had the mob, thousands and thousands of citizens who were on the welfare, who were vulgar, uncultured, vicious, unpredictable and resentful because of the circumstance, selfish, and you see, and this was the reason for the Roman games, the gladiatorial contest, the shows. What was the cry? Bread and circuses. Give them food, keep them quiet, and entertain them to keep them from overthrowing the government. At entertainment, had to interesting. In George Orwell's 1984, he had the common people in this prophetic novel, and the government had to feed them, but to keep them entertained, they used pornography. And the Romans did exactly the same thing. And this is why, from Augustus' age on, the games had to be more and more vicious. There'd be more and more deaths. Be more and more vulgar. Oh, and not just the games, the plays were very common in the first century, for instance, had Roman plays where they would have explicit, have sex acts on stage. The constant part of Orlando now. And they would have the most perverted, vicious thing you could possibly imagine. because the people kept crying for more. It was pornography. It was pornography anyway. It would show humans having sexual intercourse with animals. This was staged. It would have animals. This is how the Christians were used. To placate and get somebody, this is very convenient, needed somebody anyway. The worst criminal, they would, the mob, they made the lie in putting a few fellows in the, down there and putting their hungry lions in on them. Everybody had a great fun. Or watching the gladiatorial contest. Strong killing the weak. And you see, the nature of this thing, pretty soon people get bored of it. They have to have something more vicious, more sadistic, more perverted, more killings, more blood, more sex. And it all began, you see, it was this period that we're talking about. It was under full steam to placate the mob of citizens. And the church certainly fell victim to this. This is very important to the history of the church. Anyway, Tom, I go back to your question. I'm sorry.
No, I say Augustus is still ruling at this time?
See, what he did, he tried to reform this. I'm talking about something that's leading up to this. He limited the goal of this getting of bread to 200,000. He tried to stop it. He tried to straighten the thing up as best he could. Very little success. I'm trying to show the condition that created this, some of the conditions. You all have to follow me? There was up to this time. For instance, the men bring back in the day, the Punic War, many of these lost the family estates. Slavery, one of the things that really killed the Roman Empire was slavery. It demoralized the people. For instance, you find this still in the South. It's a part of the Southern culture that a white man, either is a man of leisure or appears or claims to be. We're getting away from this now, but this is in a part of the Southern culture. Why? See, you realize that in the Civil War, the war between the states, that less than one white man, white Southerner, out of 100 actually had slaves. There weren't very many people owned slaves. You just count up. The vast majority of the white Southerners who died in the Southern cause never owned slaves. Dying. But you see, a part of the justification was, part of their concern was, that there was always somebody beneath them. I'm above somebody. And therefore, as long as I'm white, you see, there's somebody beneath me. This was all Roman. You know, he's a citizen. There's somebody beneath him on the social scale. Everybody else wants to be there, somebody else. So it produced. This was. I'm going on a long time. This is one of the reasons that the empire was falling. The republic crumbled. See, Caesar was trying to put it together, and Augustus was trying to put it together. Society was falling apart. What was your question? Did I answer it? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to pick on the South, because everybody's like this. You have. It's interesting that North was very self-righteous about slavery. So that's one because they tried to do work. So it's not a matter of it's not a reason for that. It's on human nature. It's very demoralizing. Well, I don't know what the point I tried to make was, but for instance, the old Southern aristocracy, they had a cult of leisure. What did a woman do? The idea of Southern Belle. If she was really the perfect lady, did not know how to cook, did not dress herself, spent her time painting china, writing and reciting bad poetry, patterned after Sir Walter Scott, playing the piano, going to tea parties, and she was expected to faint at least 3 times a day. You got the bakers. You would swoon, you know. She said. And the Southern lady was probably the toughest character that ever came down the pipe. But she wasn't supposed to act like that. She's supposed to invite Jamie in. And the one thing she would never, ever have is a suntan. As white as possible, put powder on them. to appear as white as possible. Why? You say, who got a suntan? Somebody worked out in the sun. The old Southern Belle, you see, had to be, she was totally useless, or supposed to be. She was blessed with that body. That was the image. And see, this is the Romans. See, this is very demoralizing. It's interesting, and we have, and most of the American idea is, which was the Calvinistic idea really helped us in this, is that they can do the work. A man, we respect a man, will go out and, you know, do his part, carry his share of the load. My father-in-law says, any man doesn't ever earn it, he says, carry his share of the load. but you see that this is a very different ethic. Okay, well,
citizen that you wanted out of town.
And the man who got the most votes had to leave town for 10 years. It was honorable. It was honorable exile, that is. But what this was, the system of checks and balances in a man who was getting too powerful. I mean, you know, he didn't hate the man. They want to kill him. Rather than have a revolution, you know, to get him out. They have an ostracism. And you know, so we started this later on, they ostracized him. But, well, this is a good one. This doesn't make sense. Say, better than a war, isn't it? Think about what that would say when we're in Iran now. Say something like, okay, this constitution, if enough people wanted to have a vote, then they could, enough people voted, he had to leave town, and he just, you know, wasn't a great, wasn't a crime, wasn't a criminal, but he had to stay out of the country for 10 years.
Shaw would be there.
Yeah, he'd be gone. But it wouldn't say a lot of killing. Well, the Romans had this, that is, if a man were a political criminal, that is, he hadn't stolen anything or killed anybody, but he held political views that were dangerous, they simply banish him. They get out of town, stay out. Now, but what they would do is they would, let's say, either beat a man or put him to death or fine him or take his property or a combination thereof or banish him. Then they would do is put him in a cell and feed him and hold him the rest of his life. You know, and the only time they kept him in jail, for the most part, there was some exception, but the only time they kept him in jail was when they were awaiting trial, then they had to pay for it themselves. Or if they were nobility and they were sort of there for safekeeping. For instance, Herod Agrippa was a good friend of the Emperor Caligula. Later on in the Testament period, we'll get to that, but we'll mention it again. But Herod Agrippa was put in jail because he fell out of favor with Claudius, but he's a good friend of Caligula, and when Claudius died, Herod got out, and Caligula gave him a set of gold chains to commemorate, to replace the metal chains that he had to wear while he was in prison. That was an exception. A common man would not be put in solitary. He would have sentenced him 20 years, and they might sentence him to the, but the criminal, they became, in fact, what if it was a bad crime, or a very dangerous man, the man became, in effect, a slave. And he might be saying, it was the criminals, or the runaways, or the dangerous ones that were sent to the galleys, to the galleys, to the salt mines, or when they would be worked for that, the life expectancy was short. It's something similar to this in American slavery. By the way, American slavery was one of the most vicious times of slavery the world has ever known. As the center of the South economy moved from the eastern the Carolinas and Virginia and the tobacco aristocracy, as this ran out and it developed in the mid-South, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, cotton became cane and cane, sugar cane, and slave trade became profitable and slaves were bought and sold and moved to the mid-South. But in Kentucky and Tennessee and Missouri, parts of Missouri, and some of the northern parts, even Georgia, if a slave acted up, they would, you know, be tried to run away or stole something or didn't cooperate. The threat always hung over his head, he would be sold down the river. By that, they meant it would be sent, they literally went down the river, down to Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, to become a field hand in one of the large plantations where they would be worked, where their life was very miserable, sometimes very short. We have this in our language, by the way. He stole me down the river. This period, when this was the threat, if you don't behave, I'll sell you down the river. He didn't get a good price for a strong field hand. He'd be down there, and he would be put in barracks, you know, separate from his family, probably worked very hard under taskmasters in these huge plantations. Well, the threat in the ancient world was you go to the galleys, and you go to the salt mines, the copper mines, or even the silver mines. And so there was this very abject kind of slavery. But that was not the majority of slavery. On the other end of the spectrum, well, let's handle it differently. Let's move up a little bit. You would have the farm slave, or the household slave, or the menial. This is a person who would work, you know, out in the fields or in the kitchen. And this was a little better kind of slavery. Most of American slavery was like this, the field hands. Above that, you would have what you might call the sometimes the one job slave, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, come back to this in a second, but the slave who had who was especially, they like Greeks, they often used Greek slaves, the Romans did, to as school teachers, or to educate their tutors, to educate their children, or as bookkeepers. These were people who lived pretty fair lives. They were well fed, well dressed, they had jobs, this was a responsibility, and very often became, for all practical purposes, a part of the family. Trusted businessmen, became stewards, skilled. Now, then there was one other level of slave, which was a minority, but which was common, but numerically was not a minority, and that is the slave who became exceedingly wealthy and powerful. Many slaves became, this is a strange phenomenon, there are many slaves that all voted themselves on slaves. These were often by their freedom. We're talking about freedom a little bit later on too, but these were slaves who had become, applied themselves and become wealthy. Their owners had permitted them to, these were civilized people very often, depending on who it was, would permit them to have their own money. Very often they would have their own house, their own family. To just look at them, they would look like very wealthy members of society, very respected. And walk down the street, respect people would talk to them, except that they were owned by somebody else. They were slaves. Many of these, they would buy their freedom. But so you have, I kind of divided them roughly into four classifications, and then there would be shades of just run together as you cannot. Clear distinctions, there would be degrees in between these classifications. So I say this because we think of a slave, we can't just think of one human condition. Now, what was the source of these slaves? Let me back up again. Say one more word about the background of slavery. To the ancient world, slavery was a way of life. And they could not conceive of life without it. Now, that one person could actually become the property of another person. Often, critics of the New Testament will condemn the New Testament apostles and prophets because they, in turn, did not condemn the institution of slavery. Now, the old Southern aristocracy used to try to point out that the Scriptures condone slavery. Well, that's not quite true either. The Old Testament recognized slavery and set up strict conditions for the treatment of slaves. But often, the slave of the Old Testament was very often what we would call an indentured servant. That is, he was not simply a piece of chattel or a piece of property. His status was slightly higher than him. He was sort of a bondman. That is, someone who had put himself into a legal situation where they were subservient to somebody, or technically a slave. They were slaves. What Paul does, and we see this in the various of his writings, for instance, in the small personal letter to Philemon, Paul says, in fact, to slaves, you obey your masters. If he says to masters, you remember that this man, the slave, if he's a Christian, is your brother. Now this in effect, in the long run, did destroy slavery in the Roman Empire when it became quote Christian. But Paul did not say offhand that slavery is an evil institution, because the scriptures recognize the fact that the focus of Christianity is not to make a man politically or socially free, but to make him free from his sins. And that, and he said to masters, remember you also have a master. Remember this slave is your brother. I remember that you also have a master. And so Paul sought to mitigate it as much as he could. And eventually Christianity, by implication, did destroy slavery in Western Europe. That is, the implication of it. Now, if he had said, if it became a Christian, the purpose of the church was not to revolutionize Roman society. That was a fringe benefit. It isn't today. It was to deal with a man's personal relationship to God And but it did by implication rule out sin. That is, if a man is my brother, then if I follow this, if I accept all of this implies, then he cannot be my property. But Paul does not say to slaves, overthrow your masters, you know, does not say to masters, free your slaves. He says, remember that you have a master and free your brothers. Following? Just by implication, that's what the rule I think restore slaves. Okay. What are the sources of slaves?
Under Roman numeral 4.
Well, there were the prisoners of war,
number one, of course,
which made up the majority of slaves in the days of the Republic. Later on, there were those who were kidnapped. That is, under this, you would include armies would just often go in and take women and children, or that is, they just simply take. Just didn't take soldiers as prisoners of war, but they would often just kidnap them. And slave dealers all throughout the Roman world would often just go in and take people. It later became illegal, but many slaves simply kidnapped. Then there were criminals, I've already mentioned this. You'd have prisoners of war, you'd have those who were kidnapped, you would have criminals, that is, those who had committed a crime and had been put into slavery by the state. Then there were debt slaves. This is very common. A man would go into debt and he would have to sell himself or members of his family into somebody else's service to pay a debt. Or the state would sell him into debt. I'm sorry, sell him into slavery to pay a debt. You had prisoners of war, those kidnapped, you had criminals, you had debtors. By the first century, however, a great number of the slaves, perhaps most of them, there's no way of knowing, were in slavery because they were children of slaves. Or their parents had either been prisoners of war or kidnapped, their debt slaves or criminals. But now, they were born into it. Born into slavery. Sometimes second and third generations. If they, you follow me? They themselves were not prisoners of war. They themselves had never been to resolve a debt that they were born of the parents or grandparents had.
Excuse me. They didn't breed them?
Yes, they did sometimes. Now, for instance, get back to war prisoners. Back in the days of when the fight was going on, we show you that, you know, this, let's say how this really expanded in the early days. Remember I thought that when the Romans had expanded in this period preceding our New Testament times, back in the days of the second century before this, and the second century before this period, everybody talked about as Rome was expanding and gradually gaining control of this area, north of Greece, called Epirus. For instance, when they defeated Epirus, they took into slavery, this is the second century BC now, 250,000 slaves. 150,000 of these were the entire male population of Epirus. But when they conquered this land, they said, took all the men, the entire male population, instead of 150,000, were into slavery.
And they took those slaves like that, they were property of the government, and then they sold them or used them?
Yeah, they sold them. Don't sell them to raise money, fight the war. And sell them to farmers. Now, and also there was a great influx of Greek slaves. The Romans liked Greek slaves because they tend to be cultured, educated. The Romans had a love-hate relationship with the Greeks. They hated the Greeks. The Greeks were a funny people. The Greeks, as I said, were extreme individualists. Many of them, they were very proud of their culture, their literary culture. The Romans borrowed their philosophy, their literature, their drama from the Greeks. Even the best Roman literature was simply Latinized Greek literature. stuff. He even translated the Greek plays. A good when the Romans were going to get serious about education, they had to study Homer, and they studied. So the Romans wrote business manuals, but they didn't write poetry. And they borrowed the poetry, they borrowed the religion, really.
And what was Rome like before they started modeling?
It was a hard-headed business-like warrior class, commercial. They were not dreamers, they were pragmatists. Hard-headed businessmen. Stern soldier, not the poet. Now the Greeks, on the other hand, they're high culture, they're proud, they're arrogant about it. And as far as knowing how to run as far as politics in the system, they were total failures. And Alexander the Great, I say, his empire lasted, didn't last as long as his funeral. And because he didn't have an empire. Well, they sure wrote great songs. And the Romans, for instance, hated the Greeks because the Greeks were a part where homosexuality was a way of life among the Greeks. The Romans hated that. The Greeks, for instance, much of the statuary of ancient Greece was nude statuary. It was male statuary. Whereas the ancient old Romans, they thought it was a great shame for a man to even take a bath at the sun. His nudity was very much looked down upon by the ancient. Now, by the first century, they were getting to accept it. Homosexuality was becoming a problem. But for many reasons, the Romans hated the Greeks. For some reasons, they respected them. They borrowed their literature, sort of love-hate relationship. Now, many Romans became exceedingly rich in the old aristocracy. We read, for instance, the Pliny the Younger. We have a letter from Pliny the Younger, which is he from the governor of Bithynia over here. And he writes and tells about the persecution of Christians. Pliny had 500 slaves.
A lot of slaves.
We read of some who had as many as 4,000 slaves. Plato, way back in the 5th century of Greece, had said, quote, slaves are a troublesome piece of goods. They really were. Slavery, by the way, while it has been an economic boon for obvious reasons, it's not the only thing. Slavery has always been as much a problem for the slave owner as it is for the slave. It was in America. Do you know that before the discovery, before the institution of cotton and cane, sugar cane, that the South came within one or two votes of eradicating slavery. Legally. Simply because it was too expensive. And it was only with cotton that we would pay again. That's where it was revived. Almost died out in the South. And in America, you see, slavery made, the institution of slavery made life miserable for the slave owner. For instance, there had to be, it was very expensive, and there had to be the American, interesting, white plantation owner, the slave owner, especially those in the Deep South, especially those on the margin of the slave, lived in constant fear of his slaves. And as a result, for instance, they never allowed, whenever slaves ran away, they never allowed this fact to be published in the newspapers. And whenever a slave revolted and killed someone in the family, killed his master, this fact was never published in the newspapers. And historians have a tough time dealing with it because one of the main sources of historical documentation are ancient, our own newspapers. They simply would not print them. And they tried to, part of this, they tried to create the illusion that the slave was just happy, you know, fellow scratched his head and shoved his feet, and he was glad for an ample mass of perfectly happy. It was an absolute lie. Hundreds and hundreds of white people were killed as slaves, but nobody ever knew about it except the immediate Hungarian, and never published it. They did not want them to know where the next town was, you know, or how far it was, say, to the north. They tried to destroy all sense of direction because this would hinder them in running, or would hinder them in uniting, getting together, communications. There's many slaves, for instance, the Mississippi, took off, headed north, and they thought north was the 2-day walk over the hill.
I'm wondering where America got the first idea of slavery. In Britain or something like that?
It was slavery in Great Britain, where it was America. Now, the British institution before invaded the colony of America. For instance, the slave in America, the white slaver, for instance, always tried to create a fear of water in the slaves. Stale water, you'll drown, or the alligators will get you. Because if you can get into your afraid of water, then every river was a barrier. Afraid to swim for it. And they systematically created this fear. And made, in fact, in many states, it was illegal for a slave to learn how to read. Why? Anything to isolate them, to keep them separated, and to keep them there. If they were afraid to run away or to get together. Or didn't know how. But he said this took a lot of pressure upon the white man because the white slave owner lived in constant fear of the slave, had very good reason to. And nobody really knows how many slaves did run away, or how many revolted and killed their masters. Far more than anybody ever dreamed, because it was always denied. And this men taught me this illusion of Stephen Foster wrote way down upon the Swanee River, it's summer, the darkies are gay. they'd be happy. Perfectly happy to be there, It's absolute lie. But you said they had to create this illusion. And they want everybody else to think, they want everybody to think everybody else is happy. Because it was like sitting on a powder keg. You sit on a powder keg, it's a beauty blanket, it's no fun. And the white man found it. So it's always been this way. Slavery has always been as much trouble, almost as much kind of trouble. It's always been just about as much trouble for the slave owner as for the slave. Now, for instance, I mentioned Spartacus yesterday. In AD or in BC 73-71 BC, this was the generation before our period. Spartacus led an army of 20,000 ex-slaves, gladiators, and criminals in a revolt. And the Romans had a terrible time putting them down. And they made their headquarters on the slopes of the famous Mount Vesuvius, the volcano. That's where they hid out. Pompey, who was involved in the murder of Caesar, he became famous because he put down the slave revolt. We captured about 30,000 of them. I said 20,000, but we had 200,000 slaves revolted. That's a lot.
Yeah. What was the main thing?
Spartacus was a movie made of this. Now, so, it's always been so. Any questions on that?
What's the name of the place you know the
Vesuvius? Mount Vesuvius. 200,000. Think about that. You indicate there's a lot of.
Maybe 30,000 Confederate and the rest would
scatter or kill. Now, where do we. And slaves very often ran away. It's very common. And of course, the most famous runaway slave, as far as we know, of our period is who? the first century.
Onesimus.
Onesimus. Ran away. And Paul wrote this first letter to Philemon, by him we sent him back. Well, you see, so this is very much in first book of the background of New Testament studies. And by the way, you see, what Onesimus did was Paul ran into Onesimus, or Onesimus ran into Paul, or they looked him up, and I don't know, but the law was, if a slave ran away, he would have an F in the fugitive, branded into his forehead, or he put to death. It was a capital crime to run away. And so, by the way, because of this, well, so I'll show you how this is important. You're going to be glad you came today. It's going to be a big show. Because of the slave law, that a man was, if a slave, once a slave ran away, anybody, if he was ever caught, he'd be branded and put to death. Very serious. That's the reason why the book of Ephesians in the New Testament is named Ephesians. I'll tell you what. Get your attention now. See, what happened was that Onesimus found Paul in Rome, and Paul sent him back. And he sent him back, but he carried three letters with him. He carried a letter to the church of Colossae, because he was from Colossae. Philemon, yes. He was the leader of the church at Colossae. So he carried in his possession, when Paul sent him back, he carried three letters. He carried the Colossian letter. He carried Philemon, his personal letter, to his master, and he carried what we call the book of Ephesians with him. But it wasn't simply written to the church of Ephesus, it's a circular letter. In this valley, there was a horseshoe, this was called the old Roman postal here in the Lycus Valley. There were seven major cities, and these seven are the seven famous seven churches of Asia. And the book of Ephesians was written initially to the same churches that the book of Revelation was written to. And if you look at the book of Revelation, you find that the seven churches are listed in the order that they come on this road. If you start up here, look at the turn over to the book of Revelation. To the seven churches, to the church at Ephesus, right, first one. So if you start in Ephesus, by the way, start in Ephesus, which is the most important city, and you go. Tom, his horseshoe, his circle, to these cities, these seven cities, Smyrna, Sardis, Thyatira, Philadelphia, on down to Laodicea, you get, about, and what I'm saying is that the way the churches are listed in the book of Revelation are the order that come on that road if you start at Ephesus and go down to Laodicea. It's just the minority, spoke to one, who spoke to the other. Now you get some of these Jake Lake fundamentalist wildcat prophecy that the seven ages of the church were in the Laodicean age now, when the Philadelphian age. You know, you ever come across that? And dispensationalists do that a lot, this Calvin kind of thing. But a piece of pure bona fide government spec, grade A payment. Those seven churches are listed in that order, according to Revelation. Not because